You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, ring-tailed lemurs, orangutans, and the Javan slow loris are all facing extinction in the next 25 to 50 years, according to a new report. We'll find out what's behind that threat. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Yesterday, a spokeswoman from Attorney General Brad Schimel's office said that the state tested 9 of Wisconsin's 6,000 backlogged rape kits since they got a federal grant more than a year ago. Robert Menser joins us now to share the details of this and other top stories from the past week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, and he's with us every Friday at this time for our weekly news roundup. Rob, welcome back.
Hello, thank you.
Well, Rob, Attorney General Brad Schimel's office received $4 million in grants from the federal government and New York prosecutors over a year ago to test Wisconsin's backlog of untested rape kits. Since then, we learned 9 kits have been tested. What happened?
Yes. So, indeed, the Department of Justice received that grant money in October of 2015, but this goes all the way back to October of 2014, I think it was October. Certainly in 2014, it was when our USA Today network first reported the existence of these 6,000 untested rape kits sitting in police storage. So these are kits that contain evidence taken by a nurse in the aftermath of a sexual assault, and the state has a whole bunch that are not tested. So as of October of 2016, when a follow-up report found that there had been little action on moving after following these receiving these grants, as of October of 2016, the Attorney General said that that there would be, the first results would come in the next few weeks. So now it is 2017, and we're up to 9. Now, to be quite fair, there are another 200 rape kits that are in the process of being tested. They get tested by a private lab, and a DOJ spokeswoman said the lab allows 200 kits to be sent per month. But I think anyone would have to say that after, we're, 2.5 years later, only having 9 results wouldn't be considered a encouraging result.
And there was some ambiguous communication that happened early on. It sounded like at first the spokeswoman was saying 300 kits had been tested, and then that number changed to 9.
Right, and I mean the tests take time, and I assume that's what is going on here. The DOJ was had some strong language in the response to one of our reporters, saying that it's not fair and irresponsible to claim that they haven't taken action on these kits. They have in fact initiated testing, but I mean I think it's worth considering. So even at the pace, let's say they can send 200 kits per month, even at that pace, it would still take 2.5 years for the state to process the full backlog that exists. And this, the fact that they only have 9 at this point would seem to indicate that, it's not as if you send 200 per month and then you get 200 back at the end of the month. It may take even longer than that. So it feels to me like it's a valid question. What is the reasonable timeline to complete these testing?
And what is the plan to test them going forward? Because I know part of this time after the grant was spent figuring out how to test them. So what is the plan?
So this is, to some extent, this is an unresolved question. So there are reasons why a kit might not be tested, and to understand what is going on here. It's not the case that there are 6,000 women whose cases haven't been tried, or all of these are in limbo. So, for instance, if a rapist pleads guilty or is sentenced, the kit may not be tested. If a rapist's defense is that he did have sex with the accuser, but it was says it was consensual sex, then the rape kit as evidence may not be seen as useful by the defense. And there are some cases where a rape survivor has actually asked the state not to complete the test. But the problem is we really don't know how many of these 6,000 kits fits into any one of these categories. There's an argument by advocates for victims that says that the state should test the entire backlog and use that information to try to identify serial rapists or help solve other cases, future cases. But it's just hard to get a sense of where, you know, how to classify these 6,000 kits.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now from USA Today Network Wisconsin, and we're getting caught up on the latest in-state news. And also this week, UW-Madison officials proposed that students who transfer from one of several two-year colleges to the UW's flagship campus, that they get at least 1 year of free tuition if they're the first in their family to go to college. How would this proposal work?
Yeah, so this is an interesting proposal. It seems to be designed to serve a couple of different ends. On the basic level, free college tuition is a popular idea. I think the policy got a boost when it was a key part of a policy proposal in the campaign of Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. That was a national campaign. That was a big, broad policy that was meant to apply very broadly. This is much narrower proposal, much more targeted idea. But I think it's broadly consistent with the idea of making higher education more accessible, and especially making it more accessible to those students for whom going to college might not be the easy or the kind of expected path, and so therefore targeted to first-generation undergrads.
And the university statement, it does say that this proposal depends on, quote, if UW-Madison receives sufficient new investment, end quote, in the next state budget. So what do you make of that statement?
Yes, this is sort of the other thing that this proposal is up to, right? I mean, one thing it does is it would create a plan that would address a real trend, which is a drop in the number of first-generation undergrad students at UW-Madison. That is really going on, and the Wisconsin idea and the mission there is it would be consistent to try to expand that number. But, there's politics, too, and I think that the UW-Madison Chancellor, Rebecca Blank, also understands that we're heading into a state budget cycle. In the last state budget cycle, the whole UW system overall took a $250 million cut, and so this is premised on the notion that the school would need to receive this sufficient new investment in the state budget. So if this is a popular policy, if people are interested in this or see this as a worthwhile policy on substantive grounds, then it would take money.
And Rob, just very briefly as we wrap up, Governor Walker has also said that if President Donald Trump and the administration is interested in going national with a version of Wisconsin's Act 10, that he would be there to help. Is this something that's in the works?
Yeah, it's a little hard to know if this is actually something that could happen or if this is just kind of a shiny object for the press. But it is true. Governor Scott Walker was in Washington. He says he spoke with Vice President Mike Pence during his visit to the White House on Friday about the possibility of sort of a national Act 10, something that might limit collective bargaining rights for public employees unions. Very hard to say, right? I mean, no, there's certainly no policy proposals released on this, but Walker did say that this was a conversation, so maybe it'll be something that catches the eye of the Trump administration.
We'll keep watching that one. Rob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Rob Menser, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He's with us every Friday for our state news roundup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, President Trump vowed to overturn the rule prohibiting tax-exempt religious groups from political activism at a national prayer breakfast. We'll learn more in a little bit. First, If a new report is accurate, a majority of the world's non-human primates could go extinct in the next 25 to 50 years. The group Conservation International recently issued a report showing animals like orangutans and lemurs are in particular danger, in large part due to habitat loss from agriculture. Anthony Rylands joins us now. He's a primatologist, a senior research scientist at Conservation International as well, and he helped co-author that report. Anthony, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Yes.
Anthony, how dire is the news for the world's non-human primates?
It's quite dire. More than 60% now are now considered threatened. Some of them are really very seriously threatened. So that's about, that's totaling about 690 species of primates, species and subspecies. So that's a lot of primates are in danger.
Right, 60%.
And a lot of them declining.
And when we use the word primate, it can feel a little bit distancing. What primates are we talking about specifically?
It's the order primates, which includes lorises, tarsiers, lemurs, monkeys, apes, gibbons, the great apes and the gibbons.
So we're talking about orangutans, the ring-tailed lemurs, like they were popularized in the movie Madagascar.
That's right.
Some key primates that we know about.
Well, the ring-tailed lemur is somewhat in question, in fact. We just had a report published which shows that their populations are declining very severely in Madagascar, and they're now down to about 2,000. Which is quite possibly less than there are in captivity now. These population declines, when they're monitored, can sometimes be very, very precipitous.
What kinds of factors did you look at in this report to figure out what kind of shape primate populations were in?
We're based on the IUCN Red List. It's a series of categories and criteria qualifying factors where we can judge on various reasons why an animal is in trouble. And this can be in terms of total numbers, in terms of population declines, in terms of the threats and habitat loss. These are all quantified, and we come out with one of three threatened categories, which is either critically endangered, endangered, or vulnerable. Those are all the threatened categories.
And what is the biggest threat to the survival of these primates that you're talking about, like lemurs and orangutans?
Well, there's two, really. One of the major ones is the loss of their habitats. At least 90% of all the primates live in tropical forests. And since the 1970s, these tropical forests have been beleaguered with being cut down and converted to the land being converted to other uses for logging, for agriculture, all sorts of reasons why these tropical forests are being lost. So in many aspects, the report we put out is an indictment on the problem with tropical forests, because these are their habitats, and these are being lost, and all the amazing and rich biodiversity that goes with them. The other major factor is, of course, is hunting. They're hunted for food, and especially in Asia, they're often hunted for pets and for traditional Chinese medicine and so on. And the slaughter is quite considerable, to the extent that in many areas you now have what we call empty forests. The forest is still standing, but there are no primates left in them.
So do we know, when it comes to the agricultural aspect of it, do we know whether this is small-scale farming, a family farmer who's trying to feed his or her family, or are we talking about, bigger interests here?
Well, really, the bigger interests. There are enormous areas of forest now being converted into agricultural land. In the Amazon, it's particularly for soybeans, and the sort of slightly agonizing thing is these soybeans are used for making cattle feed for cattle in China, this sort of thing. And also in Asia, you've got an incredible devastation of forests now resulting from the growth of the palm oil industry. Oil palms are now replacing enormous areas of forest, endangering the rich primate fauna there. And most especially, as has been much advertised, the orangutans. Small-scale agriculture, though, is okay if you haven't got too many people. But with burgeoning numbers of rural populations and so on, it comes to a situation where it's not, and the slash-and-burn agriculture becomes unsustainable. You know, they're permanently cutting little bits of forest and making their farm and then moving on and cutting more forest. With too many people, that also becomes a threat to primates, many of whom, for example, live in very restricted ranges. They only occur in very small areas. And so even a small loss of forest can often be very endangering to the entire population.
It sounds like you can zero in on this by focusing on four countries. Just four countries are the biggest part of this problem. Can you tell us about those countries?
Well, there are certain countries which have larger, you know, a larger proportion of the primate fauna than others. Particularly rich is Brazil, the country with the most primates, in large part because of the Amazon, but also also Indonesia, Congo, and other countries which you know have very rich faunas as well.
And you said the lemurs, that they're only found on Madagascar, is that right?
Madagascar, that's right. There are 111 species of lemurs on Madagascar, and more than 80% now are considered threatened, and that's because of widespread forest loss and also fragmentation. Fragmentation is also the devil because it isolates them into small forest patches, and they are unable to travel between the patches. So although you might have a total number, which is quite large, they live in very small patches of forest, isolated, and are liable to wink out as further degradation occurs around these small forest patches.
We're talking with Anthony Rylands right now. He's a primatologist and a senior research scientist at Conservation International. And we're talking about a new report that he helped author showing that a majority of the world's primates are likely to vanish in the next 25 to 50 years. And Anthony, it sounds like working on primate conservation is not a one-stop shop. It sounds like there's a mixture of national policy, local policy, corporate behavior, and more. So how do you go about working on this?
You're absolutely right. The problem has to be attacked at various scales. Much can be done at the local scale, working with local communities, because you can show that keeping their forests and even keeping their primates can be highly beneficial to local communities in terms of maintaining healthy water supplies, and also in many situations we have now, especially in Madagascar, they can use these primates and the little forests they keep for tourism. And you've got quite a number of enterprises in Madagascar now like that, with sort of sui generis guide associations and with all the economic benefits that come from it, from hotels, restaurants, and increases the livelihoods, improves the livelihoods of local communities. But you go up from there, and you have to deal as well with major development interests and so on. We were talking about the agricultural, you know, industrial agriculture, and logging and dams and these major attacks on the environment, which, you know, I'm not saying they shouldn't happen, but it is possible to work with these organizations to make it happen with much less environmental destruction. And in many cases, just little tweaks to major schemes can have enormous benefits for maintaining healthy ecosystems around them and maintaining your tropical faunas.
And some people might hear a story like this and say, well, I can go to the zoo if I want to see a ring-tailed lemur or an orangutan, and we can always breed these species captively at zoos and then maybe work on reintroducing them down the road. What would you say to convince people that preserving these species where they live now in the wild is worthwhile and important?
Well, there's the ethical and moral things about, you know, preserving life and preserving our rich biodiversity. Incredibly rich biodiversity this world has. I think it's desperate when you think of all these species just being eliminated just for to make soybeans or to cultivate soybeans or to have palm oil. But reintroduction is not that easy, but you've got to have somewhere to reintroduce them and somewhere which is safe, not just any old bit of forest which is going to be cut down. But the important thing is that these primates are part of a tropical ecosystem, tropical forest ecosystem, which is absolutely fundamental for human well-being as well. These tropical forests are vital for, they influence local climate favorably. They provide fresh water. They're often vital for you know, as part of a basin which is providing water for the big cities. The loss of tropical forests is often, or has been on many occasions, found to be closely associated with disease epidemics or local disease outbreaks. And these forests, they provide fruits, they provide resources for local, for rural communities, which are indispensable. You know, they sustainably, they can use timber for making houses, they can use the fruits, they can use the medicinal plants, which they like to use, and so on, firewood. If this is done sustainably, this is extraordinarily important for, very important for rural communities. And much can be done instructing rural communities about, you know, the way to be sustainable. But when you start cutting tropical forests on a big scale, you get major changes in local climates, and you get you get erosion of the land. Erosion in Madagascar, for example, is a big, big, big problem. And this erosion causes rivers to fill up with silt, and so you get cycles of total flooding, and with a change in climate, total drought. And you also get soils which are not, you know, which come down to bedrock and are completely useless for agriculture. These disturbances on a grand scale like that do have very serious major effects on local climates, water, and so on. And these are major problems for the future. And water supplies and climate change are very serious problems for the future.
Anthony, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Anthony Rylands is a primatologist, senior research scientist at Conservation International, and he helped write a new report showing a majority of the world's primates are likely to vanish in 25 to 50 years. Coming up, President Trump has said he wants to overturn the Johnson Amendment. We'll find out how that could change the restrictions on churches and other nonprofits. After the news, I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. This week, Ken and his guests look at President Trump's decision to nominate Judge Neil Gorsuch of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals to replace Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, President Trump may be looking to fulfill a campaign promise to evangelical voters. Yesterday, at the National Prayer Breakfast, he had this to say.
It was the great Thomas Jefferson who said, "The God who gave us life gave us liberty." Jefferson asked, "Can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God?" Among those freedoms is the right to worship according to our own beliefs. That is why I will get rid of and totally destroy the Johnson Amendment and allow our representatives of faith to speak freely and without fear of retribution. I will do that. Remember.
Since his announcement that he would repeal the Johnson Amendment, Republicans in Congress have introduced legislation that would effectively strip away many aspects of the law. Carolyn Bruckner joins us now to talk about the Johnson Amendment. She's the managing director of the COGOD Tax Policy Center at American University and has worked on tax legislation in the U.S. Senate. Carolyn, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off with the basics. What is the Johnson Amendment?
Well, the Johnson Amendment is basically the political activities provision of 501c3 of the tax code, and it's the provision that prohibits churches, nonprofits, and other charitable organizations from endorsing or opposing specific political candidates. It's not a lobbying ban that's covered under other provisions of campaign finance law, but it's designed to keep charities, nonprofits, and churches and other religious tax-exempt organizations from becoming agents of political propaganda.
Now, it sounds like at the bill's, the amendment's origin, this was something that was put forward and supported by Republicans. But for a while now, Republicans in the current day have been looking to get rid of it. What is some of that history?
You know, this particular provision of the tax code dates all the way back to 1919, which is just a few years since the tax code, subsequent to the tax code's original enactment. In 1919, the Treasury Department issued a regulation that said that associations formed to disseminate controversial or partisan propaganda weren't charitable organizations. And that illustrated Treasury's skepticism that charitable organizations could be used for political purposes and still claim tax-exempt status. In the 1950s, this became a real problem and concern of Congress, so much so that the House of Representatives established a select committee to investigate whether or not foundations were funneling money for political purposes. They weren't looking at religious organizations per se, but they were looking more at foundations and other types of nonprofits. And this was in the House set up a select committee in 1952. The Senate had a separate one. And by 1954, that's when Johnson introduced his amendment on the Senate floor that was that would, you know, effectively ban the political activities of tax-exempt organizations. He was mad because he had been attacked by a charity that had been funded by a wealthy Texas conservative who used a foundation called the Committee for Constitutional Government to leverage political attacks against him.
And so fast forward to today, where does this stand in terms of the Republican and Democratic parties?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because this has been looked at intermittently, first in 1969 and then again in 1987, and Congress actually decided to strengthen it under those two occasions. And today, there are members of the Republican Party who would like to see certain tax-exempt organizations, namely evangelical conservative churches, be able to speak more freely about their political beliefs from the pulpit. However, the idea behind the Johnson Amendment is that the price you pay for tax-exempt status is nonpartisanship.
And as we mentioned a little bit earlier, before we spoke to you, Republicans in both the House and the Senate have introduced legislation that would challenge the Johnson Amendment, perhaps at the cue of President Trump. What is the likelihood that this would make it through both houses of Congress?
Well, there's been so much talk about the threshold needed to confirm political appointees that I think a lot of the debate over a lot of the issues around Senate parliamentary procedure has been a little bit lost in that overall dialogue. Because remember, in the Senate, in order to invoke cloture, which is the parliamentary tactic that you need to invoke to end debate on a particular legislative matter, you need 60 votes. And the Republicans, it's unlikely in the Senate that they would have 60 votes to invoke cloture on legislation to actually force a vote on this kind of legislation.
And is it likely that, you know, this would be the sort of thing that all the Republicans in the Senate would be supportive of? Or is it likely that there could be defectors who might vote with a different party or a different side?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that question because political candidates, when they're in the heat of campaign season, regardless of what side of the aisle that they're on, they get very frustrated by political attacks when they don't know where they're coming from. And the Johnson Amendment is designed to keep charitable organizations like the Trump Foundation or the Clinton Foundation and churches and, you know, sports organizations and all those types of charitable organizations out of the political partisan process. And I think that they would be hesitant to open up that can of worms. And if you just limit, if you just try to say, well, we really want to limit this to churches and allow churches to speak from the pulpit, well, doesn't that discriminate against other types of religious organizations? And at that point, you might actually be raising more constitutional questions than you can answer.
We're talking with Caroline Bruckner right now, talking about the Johnson Amendment. She's the managing director of the COGOD Tax Policy Center at American University. And Caroline, if this hypothetically were something that would clear both chambers of Congress and be passed as law, how big would this be? How would this change the political landscape?
Well, let's just say you eliminated the Johnson Amendment. That's one step, but you also have to consider that there are certain campaign finance laws that operate to limit the activities of tax-exempt organizations as well. I don't necessarily think that to get the real effect that proponents of eliminating the Johnson Amendment want to see, that they're going to have the kind of support in Congress for also making major changes to campaign finance laws.
What kinds of things with campaign finance?
Well, I mean, when you consider that the Johnson Amendment just prohibits these types of political activities from a tax perspective, there are also other specific campaign finance provisions that prohibit these kinds of organizations from engaging in the political process. And I can't imagine a world in which that you would suddenly see campaign finance reform on the Senate floor in the next 2 years.
And what about looking at the Johnson Amendment, at least that aspect of it, as something that would fulfill a political promise of President Trump? And by the way, House Speaker Paul Ryan has also spoken out today and said that he has long been a proponent of getting rid of the Johnson Amendment. So what about that aspect?
I think, again, I would point to the general rules of Senate procedure, which In common circumstances in passing legislation, you need to have 60 votes to get through the Senate parliamentary procedure to get a vote on a bill, to get it enacted. And I'm skeptical that there are 60 votes on both sides of the aisle that the Republicans would need in order to move this legislation forward.
And picking apart some of those constitutional issues, some of those thornier issues you were getting at earlier, some critics of this idea have said that they worry this could act as a sort of slippery slope and that, for instance, churches would be allowed to deny or other nonprofits to deny services to maybe gay, lesbian, bisexual people, as that's been an ongoing issue as well. Do you see it as something that could act as that sort of maybe first step in that direction?
I think that that's certainly something that should be considered, but I think more immediately, when you look at the rhetoric that the proponents of this legislation have been using to support it, they're only talking about Christian churches. They're only talking about specific types of evangelical religious Christian churches. And to me, the larger question is does that run up against the Establishment Clause? Are there separation of church and state issues that need to be considered in crafting the kind of legislation that would be needed to overcome a constitutional challenge in the courts?
I've seen some publications broadening what they're talking about there from churches to other places of worship. So does that change anything for the way you see this?
Well, I mean, I think the facts are that right now there are 1.5 million organizations that claim tax-exempt status. And of those, there are about 300,000 that are, you know, congregations. And that includes a whole host of religious congregations, from Muslim organizations to evangelical to Jewish to Episcopalian, Protestant, what have you. And I think that it's very hard to try to craft legislation that would fulfill the campaign promise that has been made that doesn't run up against certain constitutional challenges.
Caroline Bruckner is with us right now. She's the managing director of the COGOD Tax Policy Center at American University, and we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you think that the Johnson Amendment should stay or should go? Should taxpayers subsidize the political activities of nonprofit organizations, places, for instance, like churches or maybe other places of worship? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think about a church or another religious organization being able to issue, say, a political endorsement? You can leave that comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about President Trump's vow to overturn the amendment preventing tax-exempt groups from engaging in political activity, like, say, endorsing, maybe from the church pulpit. And we're speaking right now with Caroline Bruckner. She's the managing director of the COGOD Tax Policy Center at American University. We want to hear from you. What was your reaction to this? Do you think that churches and other nonprofit groups should be able to retain their tax-exempt status and be able to give political contributions or endorse candidates? Call us at 800-642-1234. And we go first to Paul in Wauwatosa. Paul, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, if the churches feel so strongly about speaking from the pulpit, why don't they just decide to do away with their tax-exempt status, and then they can speak any way they wish?
Paul, thanks for that. And what do you think, Caroline?
I think that that's the heart of the matter. One thing that a lot of the rhetoric around this issue confuses is what Paul touches on. This doesn't prevent you from saying anything. It just says you don't get the benefits of tax-exempt status if you violate the rules of nonpartisanship that are required of tax-exempt organizations.
And do you think that's something that it hasn't apparently been very attractive so far, but do you think that could be an alternative going forward if this this move from President Trump and Republicans in the legislature doesn't move forward?
I think that there has been a lot of IRS guidance and investigations of specifically the churches who are challenging the Johnson Amendment. The Washington Post had a great story on this, and they showed that since 2008, there's been more than 2,000 investigations of people that are challenging the Johnson Amendment, and there's been one audit and actually no penalties. And so this is something that is not on the highest profile of the IRS. Because there's so much existing guidance out there about what you can and cannot say. And I think that it's almost looking for a problem as opposed to trying to fix something that's already been quite problematic.
Paul, thanks a lot for that question. And we go next to Ben in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. My comment is somewhat similar, and it reflects the comment that your guest was just making, which is that the whole argument about religious freedom being impinged by this rule is putting the cart before the horse. The fact of the matter is that religious organizations and other nonprofit organizations have complete liberty and freedom of speech to say whatever they want. The issue comes with the tax-exempt status. By applying for the tax-exempt status, those organizations enter into agreement where they have certain limitations put on them to retain that status. So from a Republican point of view, it's a transaction, and they ought to be in favor of transaction. The other quick comment I'll make is that there are many, many environmental and other what could be thought of as perhaps liberal organizations that currently have tax exempt status that are not allowed to participate in political activities, would be happy to engage in those political activities if they were allowed to, because this rule had been rescinded.
Ben, thank you for that. And I want to go to John in Watertown really quickly as we get ready to move along. John, what did you want to say?
I wanted to say that I think that this cuts across both spectrums. I mean, the Catholic Church, which I think traditionally has been more conservative, there was just a lot of Catholic priests that were preaching that everybody should vote Democrat. So my point is that I think this cuts across both spectrums.
Both spectrums. Thank you, John. And Caroline, we've got 30 seconds left. What do you have to say to John?
I would tell you that from my own personal experience of being a Senate staffer, plenty of religious organizations approached me, met with me, expressed their concerns on issues. I don't think that this is a matter that those religious organizations don't get their viewpoints out or don't send specific issue guidance to members of Congress. I think what this is about is whether or not from the pulpit you can endorse or oppose a specific political candidate. And
And we leave it there. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us. That was Caroline Bruckner, Managing Director of the COGOD Tax Policy Center at American University. And you joined us to talk about how President Trump's vow to overturn the Johnson Amendment may be picking up steam in Congress. This is Central Time. Wisconsin is a state that regularly receives refugees from some of the countries listed in the president's executive order on immigration. According to State Department numbers, 1,877 refugees from nearly 20 different nations settled in the state in 2016 alone. As Alexandra Hall reports, groups that help those refugees to find things like housing and jobs now face uncertainty.
At Istanbul Market, in a small strip mall on Madison's west side, the shelves are stocked with items you might have trouble finding in a standard American grocery store. Turkish candy, henna, and dried molokhia, greens used for cooking meat in Syria. Abdul and Rula, Syrian refugees who have been in the U.S. just over a week, are here shopping for spices. We're using their first names only to protect them. They speak through an interpreter.
She said, thanks God, she feels better. She said, very good. She's very happy to be here. He said, I want to say thank you to the American government for welcoming us.
The couple and their two young daughters fled Syria in 2012 and lived in Jordan for about 4 years before being approved to come to the U.S. with help from Jewish Social Services. That's a nonprofit that, among other things, helps refugees settle in Dane County. Abdul and Rula arrived on a significant date, Inauguration Day, just 1 week before President Trump signed an executive order that would have stopped them from coming indefinitely had they delayed their trip just a few days. The way Rula sees it, they were the lucky ones.
It's very painful for her when she thinks about other people who have the big hope to come here for a better future and better education for them and for their kids.
Istanbul Market owner Yashar Tyrov came to the U.S. from Russia as a refugee himself over 10 years ago. When he hears Abdul was a chef and butcher in Syria, he excitedly puts him to the test. Cut your own meat and we'll see about giving you a job. Abdul meticulously chops thick cubes of red beef and folds them into pockets of plastic wrap. It's clear he knows what he's doing, and Yashar is impressed.
No, don't forget, he's good.
The two don't even speak the same language. Instead, they communicate through hand gestures and a muttered word here and there. But Yashar says he knows what Abdul wants just by looking at him. Abdul is beaming.
So I feel him. Like I come to America, I feel the same thing. He won't work any job. We give him any job, he's going to work. He's going to be happy for any money. Just happy to work in America, his life, family life.
The program that brought Abdul and Rula to Madison is a relatively new one. They are the third family Jewish Social Services has assisted with coming to Dane County.
My name is Becca Schwartz, and I am the resettlement coordinator for JSS, Jewish Social Services.
Becca says before news broke of the executive order, JSS had plans to bring three more families soon, two from Syria and one from Eritrea.
It's really frustrating because we are trying to do some important work. It makes me worry for the safety and security of the people who we would have been settling here.
Emin Bujunashvili is also shopping at the store today. The business owner and refugee from Azerbaijan says people should give Trump a chance.
Basically, what I understand about Trump, I see him, what he's doing and just clean this United States from the bad people coming in, make sure in this country, good people.
Next to the entrance, ads for piano lessons and a keyboard for sale are tacked to a refrigerator. And something new, a notice from a local law firm cautions Muslim shoppers not to travel outside of the U.S. until they've spoken to a lawyer. Alex Hall, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story was produced in collaboration with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time.